Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Ted Marmer. He's an expert on the Medicare program and a professor emeritus at Yale University. Among his many honors, he's a member of the Institute of Medicine, the National Academy of Sciences, and the National Academy of Social Insurance. Ted, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Grant. Nice to talk with you.
Well, last week I talked with on the program an expert on Medicaid, and I think Medicare is more widely understood among the public than Medicaid, but I think it still makes sense for us to start with an overview of how Medicare works in our healthcare system. Could you just sketch that out briefly for me?
Yes. Medicare is a program much more complex than it was when it was born legislatively in 1965 and put into effect in 1966. Then there were two parts to it, a hospital insurance part called Part A and a Part B, which was devoted to largely insurance against the fees of physicians.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, and particularly in 2003, a drug benefit was added. That's called Part D. And Part C, which will be hard for people to figure out, is an option that all Medicare beneficiaries have to join a prepaid group practice plan, and as long as that plan gives benefits at least as generous as the Part A and Part B and D. So it's a four-part insurance arrangement in which it covers doctors, hospitals, and drugs, and gives people an option for what in the industry of medical care is called a capitation payment for a prepaid group practice.
And so that's the benefit side. Now let's think about the paying for it side. How is it financed and paid for?
Well, again, I'm going to distinguish these four parts. Otherwise, people will never understand. And frankly, Medicare, though much more popular than Medicaid, is not better understood in its present form, but was quite understood in its original form.
Mm.
So how is it financed? The hospital part is absolutely straightforward example of a social insurance program. People work and pay a health insurance tax of 1.45, and their employers pay the same percentage. And that is the financing of the hospital. And it illustrates the classic social insurance idea, which is that the entitlement to the benefit is a function of your pooling with other citizens, but the eligibility for the program does not depend on any asset test or any test of your health circumstances. That's social insurance, not commercial insurance. Commercial insurance, the premium is meant to cover the likely expected costs. So the more likely you are to be sick, the higher the premium.
Mm.
Social insurance is the exact opposite of that. And unfortunately, you are among a crowd of, 100 people who have been told that in the last 20 years. Sad to say, and it's something I'm writing about. So Part B is an amalgam. It's confusing. It's financed by current income and general taxation for about 70%, something like that. And the remainder comes from a particular earmarked flat rate payment per month on the part of current beneficiaries. So notice the difference.
Mm.
You pay for Medicare while you're working. You pay for Medicare Part B partly from general revenues and partly from your own flat rate payment. And of course, flat rate payments of X dollars per month means that it's a regressive form of taxation. But most importantly, I think, Grant, for your audience, is to know where it came from. And it's an interesting story for anybody curious about American healthcare politics and policy. When the 1964 election took place and there was an avalanche of support for President Johnson and a rejection of Barry Goldwater of Arizona, Medicare's proposal, that year from the Johnson administration was only for a Blue Cross hospital plan that really turned into Part A. Instead, to the surprise of the Democrats, the former opponents of Medicare, both Wilbur Mills and John Burns of Wisconsin, surprised the people with whom I worked in Washington then by offering a suggestion that they add to part the first proposal, a second proposal, call it Part B, and make it equal to what high civil servants in Washington at that time would be paying for out of their employment role.
We've heard that kind of refrain through later in terms of if we should have the health care that members of Congress have.
Exactly, yeah. Or the members of the bureaucracy. And then as a further irony, and to connect to your last week's program, they went on to say, this was an executive session, so very few people know about it. They went on to say that if they don't include something for doctors, the argument is it'll be incomplete. But if you don't do something to improve the treatment of poor Americans, the AMA will lambaste them for pushing social insurance on the doctors when they don't believe in it and not helping those who are the worst off at the time. Hmm. And so they added Medicaid. It was an expansion of a current welfare program. This was called by Mills a three-layer cake, and it was a very important surprise in 1965. So how does that connect to what I've said already about the financing of this? Well, I've explained the financing of Part B. And Part D, the drug program, is financed by basically people choosing among private insurance plans and paid for at a combination of both taxes and contributions.
Hmm. So I think you may have already got at this a little bit in your explanation there, but what would you say is the most common and maybe the most problematic, I'll let you sort that out, misunderstanding about the Medicare program among the public?
Well, the grossest misunderstanding is they don't know that it's a public insurance plan, at least in Part A, of a very conventional sort, understood all over the world. That's typified by the 2009 televised example of someone coming to a town meeting and at the end of it expressing with hostility, "God damn it, keep that government out of my Medicare."
I remember that, yeah.
So it was completely misunderstood. I think the second misunderstanding has to do with explanation and not simply factual error. I think what I just said about the four parts, almost nobody understands. Nobody understands what Part C and Part D, where they came from, and why they're so different from Parts A and B. It used to be said that Medicare is relatively simple, and its hospital benefit it certainly is. But its Part B benefit has deductibles and coinsurance modeled on the ideas of health insurance of the 1950s and early 1960s. And none of this is as simple as what Canadians take for granted in their Medicare program, because they have a program covering both hospitals and doctors' bills. There's no deductibles or coinsurance. It's paid for out of a variety of taxes. And nobody wonders about whether or not when they go to the hospital it's fully covered, or whether or not when they go to the hospital drugs are covered. They do not include prescription drugs across all of Canada, and that's been an area of disagreement. But all I want to emphasize is that one program for hospitals and doctors is simple, and the other program that we have is less simple by a long shot.
Hmm. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Professor Ted Marmer, an expert on the Medicare program. Ted, how would you characterize the overall current health of the Medicare program? I mean, how's it standing? How's it doing?
Well, by comparison with the rest of American medical care, Americans are largely satisfied with their experience with Medicare. Happily, most people are not sick most of the time, so that there's two different audiences. One, the audience has a very favorable general view of Medicare because it's for decades now has been treated as one of the most stable parts of the American medical scene. Those people who are ill or injured and have a lot of experience with parts A, B, and D will find it complex, but they'll also find that the Medicare program is somewhere more responsive to questions about how it operates than, for example, our private insurance plans. Hmm. One of the most complex features of Medicare's Part B is that it involves both deductibles and coinsurance, and many Americans, indeed a majority, buy supplementary policies for these matters. And so the combination of Part B and supplementary could get confused. But even more importantly, the kind of detail that private health insurance takes for granted is utterly bizarre. Let me illustrate that. I have a supplementary policy under Part B for physicians and under Part D with Yale University, my former employer. Aetna administers that Part D program and sent me for my consideration a 90-page document about how drugs are covered in the supplementary plan. The effort to read those 90 pages pushed me into the depths of depression so great that I stopped reading it at page 40.
That was part of the idea.
Yeah.
There are.
But you asked the question. Let me try to be complete. You asked the question of what's the condition of Medicare. Mm. 2 points I would make. One is that it remains popular. And it's a little like, but not completely like, the support for Social Security in that most of the people in politics who don't like it are scared to attack it. Mm. So instead of talking about its desirability, which they think rightly that they would lose, they instead talk about its affordability. And that's where you get huge misunderstandings and misleading commentary. So let me just give you one example, if it would be useful. When a person goes from the age of 65, employed, let's say, at General Motors, which has its own employment-related insurance, and no longer uses the basic insurance plan that he was using or she was using at General Motors, and goes on to the Medicare Part A and Part B program for sure, two things happen. One, their premium in Medicare gets added to the budget of the U.S. government. And secondly, their expenditures, their premiums that are paid by the employer and the employee in General Motors goes away. Mm. So if you estimate only the costs of covering new parties coming into the Medicare program, you will think about a budget impact or a budget increase that totally misleads the social expenditures for healthcare, because given now Medicare's per capita expenditures are less than that of average private insurance. Mm. So as a collective matter, it would actually reduce the overall cost of Medicare, medical care.
That's an important point. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Yale Emeritus Professor Ted Marmer, and we're talking about the Medicare program. There are concerns that have been expressed recently in some policy circles that the new tax law, tax cuts basically, that were just passed, will lead somehow to some kind of significant reduction in the Medicare program, or a restructuring of it that in effect cuts it back significantly. I wanted to get your take as to whether those concerns you think are well-founded, and how would that actually happen?
I don't think they're well-founded, Grant. I think that the claim that they are very important as opposed to some impact, and I'll try to explain what it would be, I think it reflects actually a misunderstanding of how Medicare is financed. Part B is financed by a health insurance tax on wages and salaries paid by both individuals who are working and their employer. So how is that going to be affected by a general tax change? The answer is it's not. It's an earmarked tax. You could change the law, but that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about the impact of the tax law changes, correct?
Well, both, I think. I think there's been some concern expressed that somehow the effect of lowering the revenues to government through the tax cut is going to give advocates, and some would point to Paul Ryan as being the person they're most worried about here, but, you know, some sort of wind in their sails to actually significantly cut back or restructure Medicare in a way that does, in effect, cut it back.
Well, it's not taxation changes that are doing it. It's the effort to address the future deficits, which, of course, the Republicans are creating largely through their tax cuts. So then the question becomes, how could that impact on Medicare? Well, it could impact, for example, if there were a turn towards reduced revenues and increased patient contributions to Part B premiums. That would be one. On Part C, it could happen by reducing the capitation payments to prepaid group practice plans, big organizations like United Healthcare, and or it could affect the contributions of general revenues to the Part D plan. But the hospital payment side is completely protected from that. And nobody yet has proposed a scheme of transforming Medicare. I suppose you might over time imagine that Part C would be expanded and imposed on people rather than ability to choose. And then the amount of the capitation payments that they're willing to pay and the levels of payments that are given to these so-called Medicare Advantage plans could be reduced. But none of that's revolutionary.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Yale Emeritus Professor Ted Marmer. Well, let me give you a magic wand and allow you to change one thing about the Medicare program as it currently exists. And let's say on the one hand that you're not limited by worrying about political roadblocks like a Senate filibuster. But on the other hand, you do need to fit your change realistically into the current system. So it needs to be something that is fiscally sustainable and makes sense in terms of what we've already got. So we're talking about a realistic change policy-wise, if not necessarily politically. What would be the one thing that you as an expert in this field would want to change and why?
I would want to integrate three parts of the Medicare program. I would want a single program to cover both hospital expenses, doctor expenses, drug expenses, and post-hospital convalescence in one program paid for by a combination of social insurance taxes called what we're doing now in Part A and general revenues to get away from the distinctions among the program and at the same time change the structure of deductibles and coinsurance in Part B and in Part C. In short, to produce in the Medicare program a program relatively straightforward and relatively easy to use and not surrounded by the ideology and the illusions that deductibles and coinsurance allocate medical care in a more sensible way than doctors would if their patients did not have to think about the getting to the doctor through paying deductibles or continuing to pay. That's the one thing I would push for. It would be controversial, but it would be built around the social insurance conception of the Medicare program's hospital plan we now have.
And this probably then leads directly into the next question I wanted to ask you, which is that a lot of elected Democrats, especially some on the short lists of presidential aspirants are calling for a change in our healthcare system that they are labeling Medicare for all. And so first question is, what exactly are they calling for? And then is it realistic politically and policy-wise? It probably has some relationship in some ways to what you've just sketched out. But what are they calling for there?
They're calling for starting with the Medicare program as it is now and expanding those eligible for it ultimately, and then when you say all, for the population as a whole. The underlying imagery of what they have in mind is the popularity of the Medicare program as we have it now. The aspiration for a lot of the advocates, particularly the Physicians for a National Health Plan, is something equal to the Canadian plan I just discussed a moment ago. The trouble with it politically is that nobody who's advocating it has articulated a set of incremental steps that would be put it within the realm of political feasibility where the Democrats to return united both in the Congress and with the executive. So Bernie Sanders, when he ran for the Democratic nomination, said nothing about what first step. So, for example, the earlier versions of how you might move in that direction was to lower the age of eligibility for Medicare to either 60 or 55.
I remember that,
which would have the great merit that it would leave many older Americans short of the Medicare eligibility of the difficulties of getting affordable private insurance when it's when you're between 55 and 65. And it also would address a very important feature of employment-related insurance now, which is that over the last 10 years, there's been what you could call a hollowing out of the aspiration for full coverage of hospital and doctor expenses and drugs through employment-related insurance. Instead, it's been steadily moving towards much higher deductibles and coinsurance and much more in the direction of catastrophic insurance. And that was illustrated by what the ACA, the Obama reform, did in connection with its options in the so-called exchanges. Families were faced with, for example, a family of four could face a annual deductible of $12,000 to $14,000. Well, that's not, you know, that's not the health insurance plans that people counted on when we moved to an expansion of employment-related insurance from the 1950s on.
And there's also been calls for...
Could I add one more thing?
Oh, absolutely,
Grant?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to leave it at, with Bernie being the only person explained. I think it's also true that the suggestions of the other Democratic candidate, Mrs. Clinton, did not have an incremental plan of any sort at all. Indeed, one of the most important things to say about the contemporary state of American healthcare reform is that there's no obvious first step anywhere. The ACA was a step to nowhere. And the reason for it is, one of the reasons for it is straightforward. When you have the Medicaid program, let's say it's worth $12,000 by analogy to a private health insurance plan. But welfare eligibility, you're either on it or off it. And so when you would become ineligible by $1 more of wages, you would have a fiscal cliff that you'd fall over.
Right.
It's a terrible, you can't get there from here is my point.
And we've got a few minutes left. I want to squeeze in one particular question at the end. But before I do that, there have also been calls for something that the proponents are calling Medicaid for all. I wonder if you could briefly just explain what the most important difference is there in terms of that model as opposed to what you've been talking about with Medicare for all.
Well, Medicaid is not a social insurance program like Medicare is Part A or even Part B, really. It is a means and asset test example of what we call welfare programs in the United States or social assistance programs in Europe. And eligibility hinges, as I said, on both asset and particularly income tests. And so it faces what I've just called the fiscal cliff. So how are you going to get to all? I mean, the only way to get to all would take the Medicare, Medicaid benefit package and pay for it all with general revenues or any other source of taxation and not have a restriction to low-income people. It would no longer be a poor person's program.
Right.
But then it would be universal health insurance with a Medicaid benefit structure. So it has both the liability of the fiscal cliff if you're thinking about the current Medicaid program, which is a federal program largely funded but not exclusively by the federal government in grants to the states who administer it in ways that are subject to federal rules but vary quite a bit from state to state. And most importantly, most people don't know this, it reflects a very important and older idea in American social policy, a distinction between the deserving and undeserving poor. And the example of that is the rash of efforts now going on in a number of states to put work tests, education tests, and drug tests back into the eligibility for Medicaid. In short, to distinguish good poor people from bad poor people. None of that is part of the Medicare for All plan. It could not be more different. The Medicaid idea is an older poor law scheme that used to be pushed primarily by upper income Americans as charity, really. And Medicare is the exact opposite.
Well, this is a very, very complex field, and I appreciate the way that you have been able to break this down and make some sense of it. That was Ted Marmer. Ted, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Not at all.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.